chance to get a win. Okay, that lineup, when you look back, I mean, we had three Hall of Famers. We had guys that were borderline Hall of Fame, like Carter, you know, Olerud, guys that didn't even really get any Hall recognition, but they were tremendous players at the time.
Hello. I have to let you guys know, I've been looking forward to this Pitch Talks for a very long time. I am on a tremendous amount of painkillers right now, so I can't make any promises as to the quality of anything I'll have to say.
Would you like another beer?
Another four would be nice. I'm not going to talk very long because this segment is not about me. Sometimes we will start off a Pitch Talks with a little impromptu Blue Jays talk, taking your calls, if you will. And I know that in a venue like this, they're a lot better than some of the ones we get on the radio. Did anybody listen to the show last night? The last caller suggested that Troy Tulowitzki should be sent down to Buffalo when he's... And Shai Davidi was in the room at the time, because a lot of times he'll come in at the end of Blue Jays talk so that to get me to give him a ride to the subway after the game. And he was in there up on the back row where Tom Young hangs out and listening to this call. And he just started laughing at the guy, just broke down laughing. And it's something that I sometimes want to do, but can never do. So that was a lot of fun. We get some wonderful callers. I kind of wish that I had done it way back when Danny Shulman and Bob McCowan were hosting. And they were, you know, they didn't take any crap from anybody either, which was really good. And I kind of try to hold up that mantle as best I can. Anyway, you're not here to talk to me tonight. You're here to talk to one of the greatest pitchers in Blue Jays history, who is also here. The first Cy Young Award winner that the club has ever had. A 19-game winner in 1993 in his first year in the rotation. And I know wins don't mean what wins used to mean, but 19 wins in your first full season, in your first year as a starting pitcher in the big leagues, is pretty good, no matter who you're pitching in front of. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Patrick G. Henkin. Let it be known to all those of you in this room right now, an avid listener to Blue Jays talk is Pat Henkin.
It's true. He got me. Yeah, it's true. I do listen to it. Sometimes I'll even go the next day and listen to it on demand.
Wow, really? All right. That
sometimes
makes me
it's
feel
too late,
good.
Mike. It's too late.
Sometimes it is too late. But the late Blue Jays talks are the best Blue Jays talks. Especially weekends after midnight, they're never better than that. All right, should we start? Let's quick poll of the audience. Should we start talking about the Blue Jays now or the Blue Jays when Pat pitched the first time? Passed. All right, passed. I'm going to touch on very quickly your second tour of duty with the Blue Jays. And I don't want to embarrass you. We know that you're a gentleman, not the foul-mouthed sort of athlete that there are across the board. But when you came back, you had your ups and downs. You had a few downs, some nice ups. But that was, I was in the club in the clubhouse a lot after games as opposed to now. We got to talk to you a lot. Yeah. And I have to say, you were the most stand-up guy I've ever seen after bad starts. And you also used the word horseshit more than anybody else after bad starts.
I'm thinking you're referring to 2004.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, basically, when I threw it on the white part, I was backing up third pretty much the entire outing. So I had to nibble on the corners, and when I didn't, it was really a bad game. As far as being a stand-up guy, Mike, I'll tell you what, Danny Cox in 1993, Jack Morris, I remember them both telling me, when you have a good game, do the media, and when you have a bad game, do the media, and be a man. And I think it just always stuck with me. So for me, you know, you call me a stand-up guy, but I think for me, I just was doing my job. You know, I tried to compete as hard as I could, and when the manager came and got me, my night was over, but I always dealt with the media, and I felt like it was just part of the deal. You know, it's easy to stand in your locker when you go 9 scoreless and your chest is sticking out, and then, you know, when you get 2 2/3 and you give up 9 runs and your team gets a loss, and all of a sudden you're out of Dodge and you're in your car driving on the QEW. So for me, I just didn't think that was right.
Well, and we all appreciated that because, you know, in between the times you were a Blue Jay, there were guys who were not like that. I'm not going to name any names, but...
No, go ahead.
Yeah. You really? You want me to?
I can name a few, too.
There was... now that Bob Elliott and Mike Rutsey have retired, we may see more of Mike Ganter of the Toronto Sun down at Blue Jays games, and he's awesome. We love him to bits. And it was Mike Ganter who went after one particular pitcher after a start in the late 90s where he got his ass kicked and he was having a terrible year and not the best guy to deal with. And this guy literally hid behind a pillar when he saw Ganter coming around because he didn't want to talk to the media.
Oh, I hear you. Trust me. I played with the Orioles. I played with the Cardinals. And every team I was on, there was always that one guy that just didn't want to man up. And, you know, it's not an easy thing, for sure. You know, you feel bad. You feel like you let your team down. You know, you killed the bullpen. You go 2 2/3, and you know, the bullpen's got to eat up 6 1/3. And it's just tough. I mean, it has residual effects on the next game and games after. So some guys have trouble starting. They do. They have the 4 days in between where they're just mentally fried and they're worried about, you know, pitching 7 innings. And my career changed on a day when Mark Eichhorn was in spring training. And he came in the Dunedin Stadium, and I was my first year, and I said to Ike, I said, how many guys? I said, how did it go? He said, went good. I went 1 scoreless. And he said, but I was wild. And I said, wild? He said, yeah. And I said, what do you mean wild? How many did you walk? And he goes, I didn't walk anybody. I was wild in the zone. And I remember driving home that day from the ballpark thinking, I was just happy to be in the zone. I mean, if I threw 3 pitches in the zone, I was like telling Cito, oh, my gosh, I'm a big leaguer, you know? So that day forward, I started changing my thought process and how I challenged myself with my command and my pitches. And my career took off from that day. And I told Ike that when we had the big reunion in Toronto. And it was pretty cool. He's like, are you kidding me, man? You won a Cy Young and all. I said, Ike, I'm telling you, it was your one sentence that you told me in spring training. So you just never know, I guess, when things will click for you. And the media, I know I got off on a tangent, but the media is just, no offense.
Thanks.
I love you. I love you guys. I know you're doing your job, but sometimes it is hard when the game just ends and you're 12 minutes away, you're still wiping the sweat off, and you just blew the game or you lost the game for your team. It's hard. It's hard to stay focused and politically answer the questions correctly.
So you're saying as soon as the game is over...
Get in there.
When people start talking
to
you...
Yeah, get in there.
And they're passionate and they're still emotional about the game, it can be difficult to...
Get in there right
now. I know nothing about that.
As soon as that door swings open, get in there, yeah.
Yeah, that's what we do. Well, that's what they do now.
Yeah, let me interrupt you. The problem is that you got players that are hiding in the back of the clubhouse.
Yep.
They make you guys wait for 45 minutes. I mean, there's no secret why they're doing that. It's hard to be a man and answer the questions.
I want to ask you about the beginning. And it's funny that you say, you know, you talked about that Eichhorn thing. It's a great tangent, by the way. Feel free to go off on any tangents anytime you want. That the way we've kind of started to look at baseball now is we see, all right, well, this is what this guy is, and this is what he does, and this is what he's going to wind up doing. And there's not so much maybe credit given to adjustments and changes that people can make as they work their way through a career. But you said that changed you, and it made you realize that you have to command the zone rather than not pitch to the zone. What other sort of, you know, adjustments does one make as you get through the league? 93, you're a rookie, basically. I mean, you're a rookie in 92, but a rookie starter in 93. And I'm sure... though I don't remember, people were saying, well, let him get through the league a first time. Things will change back, and he'll start to come back down to earth. You didn't, because you adjusted back. What'd you have to do?
You know, it's funny. 95 was a rough year for me, and I remember coming into spring training in 96 thinking, I got to get back to the basics. I got to get back to doing the most fundamental thing, strike one. I ended up having my best year. I think it's also coincidental that Charlie O'Brien came over from Atlanta. Charlie at that time had caught Maddox for 2 years, and when he come over, I joined him at the hip in spring training, and I kept trying to pick his brain about Maddox. And I think the one thing that really helped me was that Charlie showed me the outside corner. And at that time, my first 4 or 5 years in the big leagues, I pretty much pitched everybody the same way. I pounded everybody up and in, and I threw my hook. And I was kind of like A.J. Burnett, but not as the stuff wasn't as good. And
but you won a Cy Young. He didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know what? That's, you know, yeah, I know, I hear you. But it's a team award, too. Come on now. I didn't, you know, there's the bullpen and all that other stuff. But anyway, yeah, Charlie showed me the outside corner, and that was the first adjustment I made that really catapulted me into having my best season. But I preach this all the time when I was the bullpen coach. You have to be able to self-coach. If you can't self-coach, you will die. You will be in AAA. You will not stay in the major leagues. It's just that simple. You have to be able to coach yourself after every pitch. So wherever the ball goes, that tells you what you did wrong. If I left the ball up arm side, I probably rushed. Stuff like that. So, you know, I always preach that to Loop and to the guys that I had in the bullpen that year. You know, you have to be able to self-coach. When you can't self-coach, I can't help you. I'm 300 feet away looking through a fence. The pitcher coach is in the dugout. He can't help you. So I think that you have to be able to slow the game down, control your emotions, and self-coach. And those are things that sometimes it might take a year. Sometimes it might take a guy 5 years. And the guys that can adjust like that pitch to pitch to pitch are the ones that have success and sustain success.
How difficult is it to throw away what just happened? You just threw a fastball that was supposed to be in, but it leaked and somebody hit it 420 feet. Roy Halladay always used to say that his career turned the corner when he decided the next pitch was the only thing that matters. And whatever happened before that, nothing you can do about it. There are a lot of guys who can't let that stuff go.
No, it's a good question. I mean, I think that you focus on 7 innings, 2 runs, get a win, a quality start, all that kind of stuff. But when I stopped focusing on that and I started focusing on just the next pitch, and I'm good friends with Doc, you know that, and I saw him in spring training and we talked for 1 in the morning one night, which is like 5 in the morning in spring training. That's really late during spring training. And we sat there and talked shop the whole time and it was great. And a couple of our minor league coaches were with us as well. And we had a really good time. And Doc said the same thing, that when he started to just focus on the next pitch, that's when his career took off. I used to tell people all the time, because I saw Doc when he was young, him and Carpenter. And I remember, I still think that Roy would have been fine pitching over the top, personally. I think he would have self-coached. I think he would have made the adjustments. Now, would he have had the career that he's had with the sidearm and the movement? I don't know. But I could tell you that he was very good before he went down. And he had a rough rookie year, and I know he came out the next year and started. But I still think that he would have self-coached, persevered, and figured it out.
It cost him 4 months, so it wasn't so terrible. They rebuilt him, but maybe, and there's no way to ever know that. Take us back to 92 and 93. You were a rookie in 92, pitching out of the pen for the most part, not involved in the postseason, but obviously watching them do what they did. And then in 93, you take that big step where, again, 19-game winner, you're pitching game 3 of the World Series. You would have started game 7 if Joe Carter hadn't hit that.
Yeah, what was Cito thinking? We had Dave Stewart and Juan Guzman.
Yeah, they were spent. You would have been fine. And they would have been available in the bullpen. And, yeah, what was Cito thinking is an interesting question on a lot of levels. But
easy now. I like Cito. We're going to go at it up here in front of everybody.
But tell me about what that experience was like as a really young major leaguer.
Yeah, you know, I had started 5 years in the minor leagues, and I had never pitched out of the pen, and I was out of options. I know the spring training, it came down to me and Eric Plunk, and I think this other guy named David Weathers, or maybe Rick Trilichuk, I can't remember. But it came down to there was 3 guys left. Again, at this time, I'm just trying to throw my pitches in that box, okay? So my mental frame, or my mental toughness wasn't that good. And I ended up pitching in the bullpen. Cito used to call down like in the 5th inning and say, Pat, you got the 7th and 8th. Now, people don't realize that he did that. And he did that for pretty much the whole year, really, because he was always nervous how it took me a little longer to come out of the pen, took me a little longer to get warmed up. He wanted me to be mentally prepared. He knew that that's the way they prepared me in the minor leagues. And all of a sudden, you're thrusted into a playoff atmosphere, and you're pitching out of the bullpen. And it's not as easy as you think. It's much easier to go from starting to relieving than it is to be a reliever, and then all of a sudden, here's the ball, go get 21 outs. I think that that's almost impossible. But, I mean, I pitched out of the pen. I did the best I could. I ended up getting optioned down twice that year. I think I spent 11 days in the minor leagues that year. I was the alternate on the 92 playoff roster, how they get to carry 3 extra pitchers. And then, you know, I go into spring training the next year, and me and Al Leiter are battling it out for the five hole. Al had a great spring. He beat me out, there's no doubt. And Dave Stewart got hurt, I think, the first or second or third start of the year. And I filled in. I was in the pen in 93 to start the year. People forget that. And I go in and I start for Dave Stewart. I win seven in a row. And then when Stu came back from the elbow injury, Leiter went to the pen. And that was the year that I won 19. Again, though, that was a great team. I mean, you really had to make it through the fifth inning and you had a good chance to get a win. Okay, that lineup, when you look back, I mean, we had three Hall of Famers. We had guys that were borderline Hall of Fame, like Carter, you know, Olerud, guys that didn't even really get any Hall recognition, but they were tremendous players at the time. So that was a really well-balanced two-way team. They could play defense, they could run the bases, and they could hit. So it was a great experience for me. My first 2 years in the minor leagues, we won the minor league championship, and then my first 2 years in the big leagues, we won the World Series. And I remember telling Sprague that, and Sprague says, I'm going to be a topper. I said, what do you mean? He says, I won twice in high school, twice in college, Olympic gold, and two in the World Series. I said, holy. And he married a synchronized swimmer who won the gold. I'm like, what? You got to be kidding me. And that's my buddy, so I wish he was here.
We don't need to talk about the synchronized swimmer who won the gold.
I know.
I remember the drama.
I remember all the drama.
Yes. I want to get out to your questions. We got a few more minutes here, but before we do, the Cy Young season, because this was the first Blue Jay Cy Young. We remember those first awards, right? Alfredo Griffin was the Rookie of the Year in 79. George Bell was the MVP in 87. Pat Hankin won the Cy Young in 96. And it was you and Andy Pettit down the stretch. And the Jays really weren't in the race. But this whole city, the whole country was rooting as hard for you to get that individual award, I think, as anything else. And it really did come down to September.
It did. I mean, I didn't make the All-Star team that year. I made it in 93, 4, and 7, but I didn't make it in 6. And I just remember having a really good second half. Again, O'Brien, I mean to bring it up, the catcher has a huge impact on your team. And I think that Charlie was a great influence on me. But, yeah, it came down to the last start. I think Pettit had 21 wins. I had 20. I won the 20th game the last day of the season. Brady hit his 50th homer off me, Brady Anderson, at the Rogers Center. And I just remember we won the game 3-1. Timlin saved the game. I'll never forget it. 20 games in one season is a cool accomplishment. Again, that comes from the team. I know I'm downplaying it, but let me throw Steve a little recognition here too, by the way. Another friend of mine that I broke in with. I was reading this thing on analytics, and it said that he would have won four Cy Youngs in a row. Like King Felix won his when he was 12 and 13. And Dave didn't even finish, what, in the top three, maybe top two. It's pretty unfortunate that they didn't look at the pitchers back then like they do today, because Dave would have been, and I know he was phenomenal here. I still think he's probably, if not the best, him and Doc, obviously. But I just feel like Dave is a guy that probably could have won the first Cy Young, let's be honest.
Oh, I think so, too. And I think that if they looked at pitchers now the way they did then, he's got a Hall of Fame argument, Dave. Oh, Steve.
I'm glad you brought it up. He couldn't even get 5% to stay on the ballot. And it's like, are you kidding me? This guy led the decade besides Morris, he led the decade in wins on a team that, you know, didn't have a ton of bullpen help. The expansion was expansion back then. And, he was a tremendous pitcher. I remember when I was bullpen coach in 11, it makes me think of these stories. Dustin McGowan is in the bullpen, and he's got this good slider everybody talks about. I said, you want to see a good slider? I said, I'm going to show you a good slider. And I had Captain Video, our video guy, who's been there forever. He was there when I played. And I said, hey, would you pull up some Steve highlights, would you? Well, next thing you know, McGowan and I are in the video room watching Steve slight swinging. Guys are swinging at his ball, and it's hitting him. Like, who gets a guy to swing at a ball, and it hits him? I mean, when you see that, that is tremendous late movement. Floyd has that. Gavin Floyd here right now, with the way he can spin the ball. It actually happened earlier this year. Anyway, yeah, so next thing you know, McGowan's in there looking over my shoulder. Pretty soon there was like seven guys. All the bullpen guys were in there looking at Steve and throwing this slider. And people forget, Dave had great fastball command, you know? So I'm glad that I brought it up, just because I know Toronto. I know you guys love baseball. I thought it'd be cool to bring up Dave Steve. He's a friend of mine. He was a heck of a player. And my competitiveness was, obviously I was born with some of it, but part of it was Dave, part of it was Jack Morris. Make no mistake about that. Because I got to play with both those guys, and I never play with anybody any more competitive than those two.
And if there are those of you who are young and not that familiar with the work of David Andrew Steeb, it is really worth looking up. Because, first of all, he may have had the best slider of all time. And second of all, Jack Morris and Dave Steeb. Jack Morris won 20 games all the time. He pitched one of the greatest games in World Series history. But they were neck and neck for the best pitcher of the 1980s. And Jack gets to the 15th year on the Hall of Fame ballot, just misses, and Steve's off the first year. Steve is one of the examples I bring up when people talk about win-loss record and how it doesn't mean anything. In 1985, the Blue Jays won 99 games, great team, their best regular season win total ever. Dave Steeb wins the American League ERA title with a 2.45 ERA, and he's 14-13. So not even really in the Cy Young conversation. But Steeb was in 80, 81, 82, three terrible teams, and just a phenomenal pitcher. And then as the Blue Jays got better, unfortunately, he was hurt in 92, and he had that down year in 87. If he'd been Dave Steeb, that might have helped a lot. But this was one of the best pitchers ever, and really isn't recognized that way. This is one of the greatest Blue Jay pitchers ever. And
I'd like to argue for a second about,
oh, yeah, sure,
about the wins.
Okay,
yeah.
I do think. No, sorry, carry on.
No, go ahead.
Let him finish.
Oh, I know you're going to make a good point. And yes, yeah. Carry on.
No, I was just going to say about wins. I do think that there are guys that pitch just good enough to lose. I'm sorry. I mean, you can look at all the analytics and look at the stats and say run support this, run support that. But when you're facing a guy like Chris Sale in today's game, you have to bring your A game, and you know that going in. And some guys can step up to that challenge, and some guys don't, and they give up four, and they end up losing, but they're statistically, it's a good game. They go eight innings or whatever, give up four, nine innings, whatever. And, you know, I do think that there's something to it. I'm not saying it's the end-all like it was when Dave played, but I do think there's something to being a winning pitcher.
I think if in today, when you're not expected to go more than seven, you're relying on your bullpen, pitchers aren't hitting, you know, it was, who was it? Marco Estrada's 3-2. Right, this year, because except for one start, the Jays have never scored more than two runs for him.
Right.
So that makes it kind of hard. But there are guys who can do that when they're facing maybe not a Kershaw, but when they're facing a Chris Sale or something like that. And those are the bulldogs that you love to have in your corner no matter what. I think Carly was going to say it's time to take some questions.
I was.
Okay, then let's.
Okay. Do you want a rebuttal or are you good?
What do you want to do? Are we picking them out of the bucket, or are you? This
no,
is up
I,
to you.
I got a good one out of the bucket, actually. We're going from the good guys, like Dave, like Pat. Okay, now we've got to bring up some of the worst. Now, this is a question that comes from Ron. All right? So, Ron, you know who you are. I'm not going to out you. And I quote, "Who was the prickliest Blue Jay you ever met?"
Prickliest?
Prickliest.
The prickliest, which is another way of saying who was the biggest prick.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for clearing that up for me. It's going to drop the spelling bee on you. Can I get a definition, please?
Could you use it in a sentence?
I would say Randy Myers. Randy Myers was the weirdest guy I think I ever played with. I played for 18 years in the minors and the majors, and I can't think of one guy that stands out. As soon as you said that, I thought Randy Myers. Just a strange bird. You know,
like
just,
be a genie weird with the like where
no,
you live
be a genie's fun weird.
Okay.
Yeah.
When
yeah,
you
okay.
mentioned Randy Myers, the first thing that popped into my head was a hunting knife and like a giant piece of kielbasa.
Yeah. I mean,
because that's what he used to do every day.
Yeah.
Right?
He's right. He had this weird cooler. He had this big thing of ring bologna. He had this big hunting knife. He had a stun gun. I'm like, this guy was a loony. He slept in the manager's office for like seven innings. But you want to know what sticks out more than anything is that he wouldn't pitch unless it was a save situation, and that always bothered me when I was in the dugout. He had more time than me. He had been in the league longer. He was the best closer in baseball the year before we signed him, and he wouldn't pitch in a game unless it was if it was tied, he wouldn't go in. If we were down by a run, he wouldn't go in. And you had guys like Plesac, guys like Quantrill that were pitching in 80 games that year, and I never understood why, again, one of our best pitchers, because in the first half he was one of our best pitchers, he didn't pitch, and it was frustrating for me. I'm like, why is... First of all, you're the highest paid reliever in baseball, and then you're not going to go in because it's not a save situation. We have a four-run lead. The manager wants you to protect it. Or we're down by a run. We want to keep the score right here. You've gone 4 days, and you haven't pitched. That just bugged me. So Randy Myers for me. That was an easy one.
One of the best moves that Gord Ash ever made as general manager of the Blue Jays was he put Randy Myers through trade waivers, and because the Padres thought Atlanta wanted him, they put in a claim to block him. And back then, that was it. You put in a claim, player got pulled back, and he's stuck with it. You can't trade him to your rivals. But Gord Ash said, okay, see you later. He's a San Diego Padre. It's a great move.
Gord Ash, friend of the show, too, eh? He's been here before.
Yeah, he was here, right?
Yeah, in the Phoenix show. He was here in the flesh. All right, Ron had a pretty good one. Anybody want to try to follow that up with a question? Hands up.
Who's next? Hands up, and Carly will come find you.
All right. Okay, while I work my over there, Pat, I have one for you. This is kind of selfish. Maybe we have some broadcasting students in the crowd. I don't know. But off the top of the show, you were talking about those post-game interviews and how you don't, by all sounds of things, you don't really look forward to them. But what, like, if you had the chance to talk to Barry Davis or to talk to Shai or to talk to Hazel or any, even Mike, the guys that are in the room, if you got the chance on their first day of the job...
Even Mike.
You're used to it, though. You got to deal with all the callers. What's your advice to them? What do you want them to know?
From a player standpoint?
Yeah, absolutely.
I would say that it's hard.
Yeah.
People forget, man. It's hard to play. It's hard to play and do well there in that league. And the guys at that level make it look so easy. It's so fast compared to minor league ball. I'm roving right now with the Blue Jays, and I'm in minor leagues, and I'm watching a Dunedin game, and the balls are hitting. I'm thinking, is the grass long? I'm like, who cut the grass? Like, I want to talk to the grounds crew guy. Why are the ball? Nobody hits the ball with authority like that. You might have one or two guys in the lineup, and they move in the minors fast. And that's the biggest thing I think that I would tell the media is that it's hard to sustain success in that league. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of guys that get up, and they get up for a year or window or maybe a 2 years or parts of four. But to have a good career and stay in the league, it's just not easy. And I think that as fans, and even myself, I'm guilty of this. I sit there and watch the games, and I'm like, what is he doing? Like, why is Sanchez? Come on, man. Climb over it. Throw the ball down or whatever. Or whoever you're watching that night. And it's easy to self-coach when you're watching it from the 300 level. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to coach when you're watching it from your TV. Because I know the game is really slowed down for me. Watching it on TV now. I'm like, man, how does he not hit that, you know?
Buck Martinez said that when he was here, though. He said he used to force himself to go sit down at dugout level and just watch so that he could remember, yep, okay, once I go back up there, it's a lot slower. But when I'm down here, it really is that fast.
That was a thing that Buck said when he started to manage. Yeah. That what shocked him more than anything else was that how fast the game was. But I have a follow-up question.
Hey, by all means.
Not to name anybody specifically, but... with what you said, and it's hard, and that's something that I try to get across to the callers too, that baseball is really hard, but does it grind your gears a little more when you have analysts who are ex-players who seem to have forgotten how difficult the game is?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure, because, I mean, I remember, like, having conversations with Palmer when I was with the Orioles, and I remember him coming up to me and saying, you know, I couldn't pitch in today's strike zone. You know, they called that high fastball for me. He was actually pretty humble, and I got along with Jim. But then, you know, later on in the season, we lose a game in Anaheim on a grand slam walk-off. And Jim, not having any feel on this given night, comes in and just says, boy, I pitched 5,000 innings and never threw a grand slam or never give up a grand slam. And I remember he said it really loud to the pitcher, and I remember feeling bad. I was a few seats back, and I thought, Jim, man, you're forgetting how hard it is to play. And it's not easy to be out there and play at that level. So if it was, everybody would make it.
Yeah. All right, I have a gentleman here.
What was it like in spring training 1997 to find out you weren't starting that opening game?
You know what? We got the rocket that offseason. I mean, it was a no-brainer for me. I mean, I remember when I was in the minor leagues, I had a rocket poster in my dorm when I stayed in St. Catharines. So for me to get a chance to play with that guy... Hey, say cats, yeah. And, so for me, Clemens, it was his whole body of work, what he had done. He actually said, if you want opening day, it's yours. And I don't remember if I did start opening day. I can't remember. But I remember Clemens being really cool about it, saying, look, man, you won the Cy Young. You deserve to have opening day. And I can't remember what Cito ended up doing. I didn't care. I mean, I still think you need five twos and threes. I think that's a better rotation than a great one and a two and then, you know. I would rather have five twos that keep us in the game night after night after night.
Seems like that's sort of what the Blue Jays have this year. A lot of twos and threes. Happ and Estrada and Sanchez are pitching like ones. And R.A. Dickey is due for his turnaround. St. Catharines, by the way, is Community Park still there? That's where the Blue Jays and the Stompers played. I ran out of gas there once. After, it's a private school? Come on. But the ballpark's still there. Very nice.
We won that league in 1986 out of high school. We had a manager and a guy that threw BP. No pitching coach, no hitting coach.
All right, here we go.
We were self-coaching.
I think one of the things we've heard a lot over the last couple of years is people evolving views of pitchers, you know, things such as Tommy John surgery, the prevalence of that, pitch counts, you know, roles of pitchers, you know, as a specialist lefty, all of that stuff that have evolved over the years. From a technique perspective, is there something that they're teaching players now that they never would have told you back in the day, or a certain way of attacking a hitter that you were like, oh man, back in 92, 93, we would never have done that? Is there something about the discipline or technique of pitching that strikes you as being really different today that's evolved over the last decade or so?
Also, can you show us your Tommy John scar?
Yeah. Conditioning has definitely changed. We used to run long distance, run pulls, do shoulder weights. I don't think anybody even lifted weights until the mid-late 80s. I signed in 86. We didn't even do cuff exercises until Jimmy Key came down to Dunedin on a rehab assignment. I remember asking him, I'm like, what's that? He goes, I'm doing shoulder exercises. And I said, for what? And he's like, well, you oil your car, right? You don't wait for the engine to blow. And then, you know, all of a sudden, everybody was doing rotator cuff exercises. As far as the way they attack hitters, I think it gets back to self-coaching. You got to go with what you got that night. I mean, you may not have a good slider. You may not have your curveball till the third inning. So, you know, you're attacking the hitters in a different every time it could be different. Just because you're going with what you got that night. You know, that's why we always look for consistency with the fastball command. And I think nothing's changed. I go back and I look at all the great pitchers I was lucky enough to play with, and I can list them off here real quickly. Steve, Morris, Stewart, Ward, Hanke, Key, many, many more. All had one common denominator. They could all throw their fastball down and away when the whole stadium knows it's coming. And it could be a 2-1 count, 3-2 count, bases loaded. It doesn't matter. They had the confidence to do that. And I think until you figure out that as a pitcher, you're always going to have a lot of bumps in the road. You're going to have a good April, a rough May, an okay June, and it's just going to be this. But once you get that fastball command, it's just like, whoa, your consistency just becomes so much better.
I got to ask you further to that question, too, trying to figure out arm injuries and protect pitchers and all that stuff. You pitched out of the pen in 92, and then you threw 200 innings, including the playoffs, right, in 93. You didn't break down until a few years later. Do you have any idea what it was when you think back? This is why my elbow exploded. Is there anything that happened?
You know, it's crazy. I signed out of high school. We had 27 games in Michigan. I lived right on the other side of Sarnia, and I played shortstop for the first 10. I think I pitched after the 9th or 10th game because of the rainouts. And then I graduated from high school. I get drafted, and my first full season, I throw 190 innings. There's no way we would do that now with a player, especially a shortstop from the Midwest and the Northern in the cold. So I guess each guy's individual. I don't necessarily think there's any right way to throw. I think we'd all be robots if there was. But I could tell you that if you have good mechanics, you usually can stay in the league longer. You're more consistent with your fastball command. I think the biggest thing for me is if I'm right-handed, my left knee, my left hip, my left shoulder is going to my target. And I think when you start to, you get old people go, oh, well, he has deception. You know what? Deception equals location for me. You know, you can say a guy's got his deceptiveness, but you know what? You go back and look on the monitor, he's painting. Chances are, now, I'm not saying for all guys, but a lot of times people go, oh, he's deceptive. They don't see him or whatever. That's true. There's a little bit to it. But go back and look at the pitches, and you see where he's making the pitches, and they're quality pitches. Nobody hits down and away. No one in the league. Batista, Eddie, it doesn't matter who it is. And I don't know, I kind of got off on a tangent on your question, but we're talking about injuries. I would say that, you know, I'm not a big believer in an innings limit. I think that each individual is different. I think you have to monitor your pitcher. You have to talk to your pitcher. You have to communicate with your pitcher. You have to be on page with the trainer. You have to be there on his side days to see how his arm's recovering. You have to watch his throws in between starts. All these things go in with being a pitching coach and a bullpen coach. We relay that to the manager, and then he makes the decision.
Did you know when you blew your elbow that it was gone?
You know what's funny? I was pitching for the Orioles then. It was like the eighth or ninth game. It was in May. And I was off to a pretty good start. And it was against the Tigers. It was my first curveball that I threw. When I threw the ball, I felt it pop and it burned. It went up to about mid-forearm. And I remember I just laid my arm down and I remember thinking, wow, you know, that wasn't right. You know, I had a lot of innings in at the time and I had never felt that one. And then the inning ended. I went back out. It was sore. I'd warm up and go away. Did this for seven innings. After the seventh inning, I came in that night and I was in the shower and I went to shampoo my hair and I just got a big zinger. That nerve was torn and I was getting zingers into my fingers. So I went into the training room and I said, hey, I'm getting zingers into my hand. And I knew what that meant. I knew I was done. The ulnar collateral ligament is probably shattered or frayed. And I ended up having the surgery, and James Andrews told it to me like this. He said, your ligament is like this, all wound together. And he said, over the years, you were just like tink, 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 tink. And he said that last one was just barely hanging on by like a thread. Because the first thing I did when I woke up, I'm like, was it completely severed? And he said, no, you still had like one fiber. But he said, Pat, I tested you, man. They call it milking the cow. They bring your arm back and they pull your thumb down to the ground. And that shot me up off the training table. And then there was another test they did here. And he's like, Pat, I'm opening up your elbow like a car door. He's like, you need Tommy John. And I was like, okay, I gotcha. Because I was trying to avoid it.
Pat, you've been such a great ambassador for the Blue Jays organization over the years in a number of different roles, I think. I was just wondering, what is it about this franchise that just keeps you coming back and invested?
That's a good question. I think that, you know, anytime you get drafted by a team, I've been with this team almost my entire adult life, minus 3 years in Baltimore, one in St. Louis. I know Paul Godfrey brought me back in 05. He had asked me to come back and be a AAA pitcher coach. I turned it down. Then in 06, they asked me to come back as a guest coach in spring training. And I remember thinking, okay, I'll do that. But I was feeling kind of funny because I was still playing. I played in 04, and there were some guys on the team. Now I'm coming back as a coach. I remember that being a little bit awkward. My role just evolved over time. I started out as a guest coach. Then they had asked me to go to the minor leagues, and I started going to see some of the affiliates. Then it actually built all the way up to, I actually saw eight guys for the draft, and I was actually borderline consultant for Alex. I mean, he would call me at 2, 3 in the morning. I remember when we did the Estrada trade. He called me at 2 in the morning. He texted me. He's like, are you awake? And I put, yeah. And he just put, I'm fired up. That was like his text. Because I responded at like 2 in the morning on the East Coast, because he's living here. So my role changed over the years. This year, I'm currently roving again in the minor leagues. I've seen Buffalo. I've seen Dunedin. I will go see New Hampshire and Lansing. And I'm in Toronto for some of the homestands per month. Not all of them, but occasionally I'm up there. So I really like the role that I'm in. I enjoy seeing the whole system. And I feel like sometimes you can make more of an impact with a 20-year-old kid in Dunedin as opposed to a 32-year-old kid in the Toronto bullpen.
All right, we've got our last question over here.
Pat, I just wanted to ask your thoughts on being being selected for induction in the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm actually nervous. It's June 18th. I got to do a speech. I'm all rattled right now. I was just talking to Scott Crawford on my way here, asking him, you know, I'm not used to doing this. You know, I've never done this before, actually. And I've done some games. I did a game in spring training on TV with Buck and Tabby. I've done a few cameo innings with Jerry before in the past, but I've never actually stood up at a podium and given a speech. So I'm a little nervous about it, to be honest with you, but I'm very honored, very humbled. And when I found out the information, it was pretty cool to call my mom and say, hey, this is pretty neat. We're going to be going to St. Mary's, Ontario in the middle of June, so bring your sunscreen.
All right, how about a round of applause for the Canadian Hall of Famer? Not to mention Cy Young. All right, so Mike, I'm going to give you the chance to wrap it up with Pat, and then we're going to take our first intermission. So hang tight. I got to give Wilner the last word. I think he's going to get testy if I don't do that.
No, I wouldn't.
On the phone, you would.
I'm not the kind of person who needs to get the last word. I just... generally, I'm the one with the microphone. I guess before we go, just a thought about this season. And it seems like the Blue Jays are turning things around. They won 10 of 13. They've been getting some good bullpen work lately. The inning that Jesse Chavez threw the other day, he looked different than he had looked all season. He was great. Strangely enough, Drew Storen has not been scored on in like 11 of his last 13 outings, though you would never know it. I got to ask, you were a bullpen coach in the big leagues. The biggest thing that's going on with this pen is that they're right at the bottom of the league in inherited runners. And for me, that's not something that can keep up with pitchers who are basically pitching to the league average in all other ways. So is this just a crazy coincidence? Is this bullpen good enough, or is radical surgery required?
No, radical surgery is not required. I think the biggest thing is first batter efficiency. One of the things I always preached when that door swung open was I always used to yell it. And actually, Hutchinson was just teasing me in Toledo when I saw him pitch, or Columbus, because he remembers hearing me say it too. And he wasn't even in the pen. So I remember asking him, like, you weren't even in the pen. What are you talking? He's like, I heard the guys talking. So I knew it was making an impact. And all I did was I said, when that door swung open, I looked at him and I yelled, get the first guy. And I know it sounds stupid, but it's the last thing he hears when that door swings open. And I think it did have an effect. And I feel it feels good when a player comes back to you 3 years later and says, hey, man, every time I run out there now, whether it's the first inning or the fifth inning, and Hutch is a starter, as we all know, he always goes, your voice comes in my head, get the first guy. And so to answer your question on inherited runners, you get first batter efficiency under your belt, and then the inherited runners take care of themselves. So I think that the relievers need to be more aggressive when they first get out there. Let's go. That's what Chavez did. That's what Storen's been doing. And I think that's the key. I think you really have to be aggressive when you come out of that pen.
First batter efficiency, not so much for Storen. It's crazy. In his last three outings, he's given up a double to the first guy and then gotten everybody else. But since you brought it up, one more question. And you just saw Drew Hutchison. I'm assuming that was a game he took the perfect game into the sixth inning?
No, actually, I saw him start before that.
Saw him start before. Well, how's he looking? He's going to play a part for sure at some point this year.
Yeah, he looked good. I mean, his spirits were good. I think that, he's disappointed. He loves Toronto. He wants to be here. He feels like he deserves to be here. And you can argue that he does deserve to be here. Unfortunately, right now, we have five guys that are pitching really well. And I think the sixth starter, as we all know in the big leagues, has a huge value for the organization. If we have an injury, we have a guy like Hutch that can step up. I'll tell you a quick Hutch story. He pitched against the White Sox. Robin Ventura was out for early hitting. I was out doing a lap out on the field, and Robin and I ended up talking for like an hour. And I remember the first thing he said was, how is Hutch in AAA? And I said, I know, I hear you, man. I said, our pitchers are pitching very well right now. He has options. You know how the depth thing works. He's like, yeah. He's like, boy, we would love to have him. So Hutch just needs to play the course, use up your options, and, you know, then the Jays are in a spot where they can't send him down. And I think until then, he could be that up-and-down guy, unfortunately.
I think if Blue Jays talk callers knew what you just said, they would be calling me for a Hutch for Deonner Navarro deal. Because the only thing wrong with this team is a backup catcher. We're going to take a break. There's Ross Atkins coming up with Stephen Brunt and Jeff Blair. There's a great writers panel coming up. Go buy beer.
I want a beer.
Buy one for Pat. And everybody, Pat Henkin.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.